Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, here at the Education Gadfly Show, online at edexcellence.net. Please join me in welcoming my co-host, the Rush Limbaugh of Education Policy, Rick Hess.
Hey, Mike. Oh, I'm the Rush Limbaugh? Wait a minute.
Rush Limbaugh, my point is, I mean, nobody wants to cross you, Rick.
Oh, I like it that way. Yep. I thought you meant that I was kind of bald and pudgy.
No.
Because I'm pudgy, but not bald.
Well, that's true. That's true. But what's your take on this whole Rush Limbaugh brouhaha?
I think Michael Steele got his clock clean. Yeah. I mean, you go on national TV, shouldn't he have said, oh, you know, I'm not really here to talk about Rush Limbaugh. He's, television personality. Mm-hmm. I'm the official voice. How the heck did the head of the Republican Party wind up picking a fight with probably the most popular Republican pundit?
Right. But, you know, I think that one thing that's for you know, very serious is that it's important for Republicans not to just be, you know, Mr. No.
I mean, certainly, right? I mean, conservative reform ought to be about figuring out a way to solve problems and not simply about opposing whatever or the left, you know, happens to put forward.
Okay. And more relevant news to some of our listeners, we had a great happy hour last week here in Washington, D.C. There were three of the Hot for Education hotties at the happy hour.
Which three?
It was a big showing. This is Alexander Russo's list on his blog that he puts out every year. This is a 2-9. I think, were you on this list once,
Rick? No.
All right. Which is a big scandal. Laura Legerfo was there, right? Mm-hmm. Libby Quaid and Steve Sawchuk, all on the Hot for Education list. We got a lot of things to cover today. We're not going to just babble on forever. We'll play part in the Gadfly. We got Rate That Reform. And, of course, Amber's Research Minute. Christina, get us started with Part in the Gadfly.
Kick it.
Topic one. This week, ACHIEVE, the organization founded by governors and CEOs to advance standards and accountability, announced the Massachusetts governor, Deval Patrick, was joining its board. This led to some consternation in certain circles, since Patrick is seen by many as trying to torpedo the Bay State's excellent academic standards and replace them with so-called 21st century skills. Is this view of Patrick fair, or is he stronger on standards than some critics claim?
Now, I got to admit, Mike, I know nothing about this. We ran a recent article in Education Next, but it was hardly by disinterested observers of the scene. It was by folks who have a certain perspective on Patrick's, you know, efforts.
Everybody has a perspective, Rick. I mean, but you're saying folks were in the government previously in previous administrations, and so they feel like they're trying to defend Massachusetts.
Sure. And I don't have any good basis on which to gauge kind of their critiques of Patrick.
This appointment does raise some concerns. I mean, the critique of Deval Patrick is that so far, all indications are that he wants to water down the academic standards or at least fuzzy them up with 21st century skills. Now, we've talked about this on the show. There's been a lot of debate recently about 21st century skills that, you know, in many ways could be pushing content aside in favor of things like teamwork and creativity, all these things that are fine, but that you might learn just as well after school as in the middle of school, and it certainly shouldn't replace history and literature and science, et cetera, et cetera.
And is Patrick pushing for these
things? Well, he is. He had a task force on 21st century skills that came out with a report proposing that the standards be changed to embody more of these kinds of standards, and that was deeply troubling to people. And so now Massachusetts is kind of ground zero in this fight where you've got the folks that believe in strong academic content on one side and then the 21st century skills people on the other. And it seems like Deval Patrick is with the 21st century skills people. So, you know, that was a worrying sign to me about, you know, giving a governor that's been doing that such prominence. Mm. I mean, it's a little bit like us saying, you know what, Ted Strickland in Ohio, who's been anti-charter school, we're going to appoint him to the board of the National Alliance of Public Charter Schools.
Topic two. A Washington Post article this week celebrated the fact that schools in the Washington region, and especially in the affluent districts of Fairfax County, Virginia, and Montgomery County, Maryland, are doing a knock-up job educating English language learners. Achievement gaps between these kids and their peers are smaller in Virginia and Maryland than elsewhere, and their NAEP scores are higher than most places. Does this mean that NCLB's expectation that English language learners reach the same standards as other kids is justified, or is the Washington region a special case?
Yeah, so, you know, this is interesting to me that we see some very very impressive data here in the Washington region and in Virginia and Maryland writ large around English language learners. And I know that you and I, Rick, have both been critical about including those students as a separate subgroup within No Child Left Behind, because by definition, somebody who's an English language learner isn't yet proficient in reading and may not be able to do well in math either until they learn the language. But, you know, lo and behold, it looks like if you put resources, if you put the right pressure, if you have high expectations, you can really move the needle with this population. Maybe we've been overly skeptical.
Yeah, you know, and my reaction when I read the article, well, it was pretty different. Two things in particular jumped out for me. One is what the article did note is that the demographics in these Virginia and Maryland suburbs are pretty different from those across the nation. These are families much higher income, much better educated. But second, and I think much more significant, is there was no discussion whatsoever in this article about any of the trade-offs at stake here. Sure, I think it's probably the case that if you reallocate resources and faculty and leadership and energy in the way that the article was talking about to serving these populations, that you can drive up their achievement levels. But what I found no attention to was, what does this mean for anybody else? What are we doing in terms of reallocating energy and talent and faculty time mm-hmm. from other kids who probably also deserve, you know, a quality education?
Though probably in places like Montgomery County, Maryland, and Fairfax County, Virginia, they haven't had to reallocate in terms of, they've made the pie a lot bigger. They have a lot more money in these systems than they did 5 or 10 or 15 years ago. Partly that's because of the real estate bubble that drove up local property taxes and brought in a lot of money into these school systems. And so they were able to put a lot of money into getting great teachers into these tough schools, perhaps without causing much pain for the other schools in the district. The question now, as times get tough, is what's going to happen? And, you know, if it becomes more of a zero-sum game, then you might have winners and losers.
Yeah, it probably depends how we talk about reallocate. It's certainly the case that you're right that, you know, these districts have been able to hold harmless students in more advanced classes, students in other schools. But it's also the case that if you're spending hundreds of millions additional dollars, and almost all of these are going into a particular slice of populations, that's a huge lost opportunity to do better by the kids.
Okay, topic number three.
Albuquerque Public Schools is on pace to lose $300,000 this year from unpaid school lunches. Kids who aren't enrolled in the federal free lunch program are showing up without lunches and without lunch money in record numbers. So the district's policy is now to give those children just a cold cheese sandwich, fruit, and a milk carton. Is this overly stingy, something out of Dickens, or quite appropriate?
You know, Mike, I don't see the problem here, frankly. If you've already taken care of children who are qualifying for free and reduced lunch, and this is and school districts are providing a lunch which you are free to buy or not buy, and children don't qualify for free and reduced lunch and don't bring money, I'm not sure why the district should be spending $300,000 to give them free sandwiches, fruit, and milk. If you don't have the money, you don't eat.
Rick, so in Rick's school, you show up without money, you're going hungry for the rest of the day.
Absolutely.
Look at that. You are a tough, tough man.
I just don't understand.
But if you read this article, now it was very sad. I mean, these kids were talking about how they were standing in line waiting for the normal lunch, and they'd get pulled out of line and given a cold cheat sandwich.
They don't have any money. Why would they expect any lunch at all?
I don't know.
Is the argument, why don't they qualify for free or reduced lunch?
Well, in some cases, they need to go through that process, and they should now qualify. In other cases, they just forgot their lunch money. Maybe somebody beat them up and took their lunch money, and now all they get is a cold cheese sandwich.
If you can't remember to bring your lunch money, you don't eat, and hopefully you remember the next time.
Now, but the thing is, this has become a big source of controversy in Albuquerque, and there has been a lot of brouhaha. There have been some parents, I think, of the more conservative persuasion that have been very enthusiastic, community members too, saying, yes, this is a sign of personal responsibility. But some of the hunger groups worried that there are children out there that are, you know, going hungry, and children who are crying because they just don't like the cold.
Here's the question, Mike. Okay, so if you're giving them either a free lunch or even a free cold cheese sandwich, which they don't like enough, heaven forbid they're lactose intolerant, so you're giving them these things, what's to encourage a child to remember to bring their money the next day?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is a nation in which we save nothing, we spend more than we earn, everybody's used to a free lunch, mm-hmm. and now we're actually turning this into school district policy?
So this is it now, Rick. You're going to give more billions to AIG, and you're not going to give a poor child a cold cheese sandwich.
Well, so we should just hang up a sign saying there is such a thing as a free lunch.
Of course
there
is.
They can put that at the outskirts of Albuquerque. I mean,
we learned anything the last couple of months, there's free lunches everywhere.
Great.
Except in schools. Great. Thanks, Rick. That's great. All right. Well, that's all the time we have for Pardon the Gadfly. But it's now everybody's favorite time is time for Amber's Research Minute. All right, Amber, you feel inspired this morning?
I'm feeling less stingy than you guys are about the cold cheese sandwiches. So yeah. Yes, I guess that I am feeling a little inspired.
Amber is big-hearted. She yeah. is. All right, but she doesn't take that kind of big heart into her look at research. She
These
takes
aren't
a
second
cold...
grade starving children.
All right, so let's see. What are we talking about this week?
We are talking about the math wars. We are plunging into the math wars this week. New study out by Mathematica for IES that compares four widely used K-2 math curricula. Interesting aside here, seven math curricula make up 91% of all curricula used in K-2 nationally. So this is an experimental study. 39 schools in four geographically dispersed states were randomly assigned to one of four math curricula. Achievement data collected from over 1,300 first grade students and analyzed using HLM. The study found that students taught with Saxon Math and Math Expressions performed significantly higher than those taught with Investigations and Scott Forsman Math.
Boom!
Ooh, interesting that the two most effective curricula, one is scripted and more traditional. The other is a blend of student-centered and teacher-centered approaches. Of the two least effective ones, one is student-centered and very constructivist. The other is a blend of direct instruction and hands-on techniques. So, bottom line, both sides of the war, I think, can claim some victory here, though it appears that the die-hard constructivist math methods are the least advantageous.
Whew.
Was that a minute?
It was a little bit over.
I mean, you know, when you really dig into the descriptions of these four math curricula, mm-hmm. it's not like one is pure constructivist student-centered and the other one's completely direct mm-hmm. instruction teacher-centered. I mean, there is a little blend going on there, but the one that was like way out pure constructivist did horrible.
Which one is that one?
That was math. Don't let me get this wrong.
Math Expressions? Is that right?
No, the Math Expressions did good. Okay. Investigations is the...
Now, are you guys going to issue a list of districts that are you making heavy use of investigations?
That's interesting. What a great idea.
Oh, no.
I will say, Saxon Math is widely used in Catholic schools.
Yeah. Mm. And that's the scripted one, right? That,
yes.
you know, where it really, really scripted. Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So, Amber, you ready for some hate mail?
I've already gotten a little bit of that from a little blog I did the other day, so I'm used to it. I'm okay.
Look at
I can
you.
Handle it. You gotta have tough skin around here at Fordham. I'm finding out quickly.
I know. So Amber, what's your take on? I mean, you've been following some of these big curricular issues. You had mm-hmm. PISA recently that you weighed in on.
Right.
You've got this math stuff now.
Mm-hmm.
So the other day I was listening to NPR and there was an interview with a high level mathematician and he made the claim that mathematicians aren't actually very good at arithmetic. Because, they're working at such a higher level of abstraction and that really what kids, we don't really need people to be good at arithmetic because of computers and calculators. We just need people to be able to think algebraically so that they can set up Excel spreadsheets.
Wow.
Yeah. So after all this do you think that argument is fair?
It sounds kind of 21st skills-ish, doesn't
mm-hmm.
it?
Mm-hmm.
This is actually, I think, the problem with expertise sometimes. Is, this is exactly like lawyers will tell you that, they don't use case law much in their day-to-day life.
Mm-hmm.
But the reality is what you're trying to build is a set of mental tools.
Mm-hmm.
And the reality is that most people in their everyday life don't need to think like mathematicians. What they need are the insights and the ability to make calculations and estimations mm-hmm. that are much more heavily derived from mathematics.
Mm-hmm.
This is, I think, sometimes a problem when we get the professoriate tries to take the lead on standards questions.
Mm-hmm.
Is what they think of as useful might be different from what's useful for the vast majority of the population.
You know, when you mentioned mm-hmm. tools, I thought you were going to call somebody a tool.
Oh.
Because Rick's known to do that. All right, so Amber,
yes.
So we've got math math curricula. What is your song this week?
So since we're getting into the math wars today, I have a battle song. It is Sunday, Bloody Sunday
yes.
by U2.
Broken bottles on the children's feet.
I have to say, it's almost a little sacrilegious to compare the math wars to the Irish conflicts.
I was going to say, great song, but a little excessive.
Thank you, Laura.
But it gives us an excuse to plug the new U2 album that's coming out any day now. Very exciting. Is this the second U2 song we've used now on the show? I think so. I think that U2 is now the only group that we've used twice. But, of course, because it's the best band in history.
Right.
Yeah. All right. So there it is.
Got it.
Undeniably. Good. All right. It is now time for Rate That Reform with Stafford. You could also rate that rock band, but frankly, we're running long as it is. So tell us what's going on in the world of education reform.
You stole my cheese sandwich story. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to talk about appliances in classrooms, which we reported on a few weeks ago that they were charging teachers for their appliances. Now they're just banning them outright. And the reason I found this interesting was that...
By appliances, do we mean like washer dryers?
I wish. No. Refrigerators, microwaves, and coffee pots in general. But the reason I found this interesting was I read this article recently about people who have gotten rid of their refrigerators, like in their homes, just completely gotten rid of their refrigerators. And they now have coolers, which they fill with ice, and they just use their coolers. So they go buy a bag of ice, they keep it in their basement, and they have no refrigeration whatsoever, which of course has to change their eating habits.
That would seem more expensive too.
Well, I don't think it's about the expense. I think it's about their, you know, carbon footprint. So the story today is actually from Glendale, California, where they are banning appliances. And apparently this has really pissed off the teachers union because the teachers want their Lean Cuisines and Diet Cokes. Mm-hmm. And they are accusing the school district of alienating them. In any event, I think this is actually a relatively good idea. I don't know if I'd go so far as to getting the refrigerator out of my own home, mm-hmm. but... I was gonna give this high marks.
Well, so tell us, but to be clear, so they're banning appliances from classrooms, from the faculty lounge,
from everywhere? Not from the faculty lounge, just personal ones in classrooms.
Okay.
And so the teachers are worried because if they don't, you know, if they don't really have a lunch period, mm-hmm. and the faculty lounge is a 5-minute walk away, they're not going to have time to go get lunch out of the faculty refrigerator.
These teachers had microwaves in their classrooms?
Yeah. And refrigerators, more likely. Yeah,
I got to go with Ben. I mean, it's one thing not to have a fridge in the faculty lounge, but this is ludicrous.
Mm-hmm. All right. So what you rating this one?
I'm actually going to give this good marks. I'm going to give it an A for problem definition. Mm-hmm. We're reducing carbon footprint. We are unspoiling our teachers. And I'm going to give it an A for execution because it's going to save the district about $2 million a year.
$2 million a
year? Are you serious?
Yeah.
Wow.
So that's a no-brainer. And I was just thinking about how many second graders accidentally stick the class hamster in that microwave.
Yet another reason.
With their cheese sandwich.
A win-win all along. Wow. And, you know, Rick, this does give me an opportunity to remind readers that we are the most environmentally friendly education policy think tank in Washington, D.C.
How so?
We don't print everything.
That's right.
We recycle
mm-hmm.
yeah. paper, cans,
yeah.
glass, everything.
We have a greenish roof.
So are you saying that as, say, compared to NCTQ or NCTAF or EdTrust, that you've been certified as greener?
I would put us up against any of those groups, absolutely.
AEI is pretty green, baby.
Absolutely. Really?
Well, we're not education specific.
Exactly.
So I got you.
Right. All right. Well, thank you, Stafford. That's an idea that saves money and saves the environment, too.
There you go.
I love it. Okay, that's all the time we got for next week. I am not going to be around next week. I'm going to be in sunny Argentina.
Sweet chili Petrilli.
So
look at
you. So it'll be a couple weeks till we're back on the air. Until then.
I'm Rick Hess.
And I'm Mike Petrilli, signing off from the Education Gadfly Show.